surgery, rescue, recovery, and resiliency. Find more at medevacpodcast.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the Medevac Podcast, powered by the Robert Irvine Foundation, whose mission is to support and strengthen the physical and mental well-being of our nation's heroes and their families. I'm one of your hosts, David Reed.
And I'm your other host, Christian Myers. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Medevac Podcast. If you're new here, there's a price for the show. You have to share it with a friend or family member if you get something out of today's episode. And today's episode is going to be pretty fun. This is part two of a three-part series. We're doing a reconnection episode, or reconnection series, rather. So yeah. Our guest today is Bernie Copeland. He was in the Army from 1988 until 2013 as a combat medic, so he's a 68 Whiskey combat medic. He's got a fantastic story. If you missed part one, go back, listen to part one with Ryan Layton. It's going to fill in the story a little bit more, and we're going to hear about Bernie's side today. So welcome, Bernie.
Welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to dive right in with one of our favorite questions of the show is, what inspired you to join the military? Was it family? Was it...
A judge?
Yeah.
It's actually a very funny story. It's 2 days after Christmas, and my best friend called me up, and he's like, hey, what are you doing today? And I'm like, nothing. What are you doing? He said, let's go join the National Guard. And I said, okay, let's go. And we went and joined, you know.
Just there on the spot?
On the spot. No thought That's whatsoever.
You didn't think about it at all before
this? No. It was just, okay, let's go.
Yeah, let's give it a shot.
Yeah. So.
And what year was this?
1988.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So yeah. there's some things spinning up at this point.
Right.
When you join, and you had no idea what you were getting into.
No idea whatsoever.
That's funny.
We went and saw the recruiter, and the recruiter's like, hey, what do you want to know? And we're like, where do we sign at? He goes, I don't know how to do this. And we're like, we want to join up, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like, so when can you go to basic? And we're like, today.
Later today?
He said, I can't make that happen. You got to go to MEPS first, you know? Sure. So yeah. I'm like, we can go today. He goes, can't make that happen. He made a call, and he goes, can you go tomorrow? We're like, sure, you know. We went to the MEPS next day.
No
kidding. Got our physicals, signed in, and swore in, you know, and
yeah.
A week later, we was headed to Fort Knox. So.
No kidding, right? Just like that, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have any family history in the military, or?
I did, okay. You know, so.
A dad or a grandpa, or?
My dad was military. Okay. My stepdad was military.
Okay. So you had some experience with it.
I had one uncle done 3 tours in Vietnam, another uncle done 2 tours in Vietnam, you know, so forth, but.
So I got to ask, like, what were you doing prior to joining the military where you just had to run away so quickly?
I was going to Tennessee Tech University in Cookeville, Tennessee, and needed a break.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so
college wasn't for you?
No.
Mm. Yeah, well,
I get that.
Lo and behold, the military, it is.
Yeah, so.
It's a good option for some people. I mean, I did the exact same thing.
Same here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did a semester of college and I didn't like it, so I joined halfway through that semester, finished it out, and then left. Yeah, same thing. So. It's not for everybody.
Did you know what you wanted to do, or you just kind of fell into 68?
Well, originally I went in as a Bradley mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
Done that for 6 years. Hated being a mechanic. I'm not a mechanic. So, yeah. You know, but on the civilian side, I went to EMT school and paramedic school.
Okay.
And then actually got out of the Guard for like 3 months, and they taught me I'm going back in as a 68 Whiskey, and rest is history.
Okay. So they brought you, did you leave voluntarily and then join active duty, or did you get recalled?
I left voluntarily. I never was active duty. I was always National Guard. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. But when I came back in, you know, they're like, hey, if you come back in, we'll promote you to an E5, you know. And they did as soon as I come in, you know. And I'm one of the few medics that never went to Fort Sam.
Okay.
Because I was a civilian paramedic, and that time they took OJT on the job training. So. Yeah.
Well, there probably wasn't much more to teach you at that point.
No, there wasn't, you know.
You probably had more experience than most of those medics at
that
point.
Right, I did. Yeah, so.
So you went back in. So what year did you go back in as a 68?
I went back in 93. I got out in 93 originally, and I went back in 93. So.
Okay. What did you do with your 3 months off?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
I mean, 3 months is a lot to just sit there and be like, what am I going to do with my life?
It was, you know, it was really boring. All my friends were at work and stuff, so.
So yeah. Did you think about going back to school?
I went back to school for a little while, and it's like, nah, it's not for me. I'd rather work on an ambulance, you know, so. Yeah.
So is that what you did with your civilian job? You stayed on an ambulance for most of the time?
I was on an ambulance up until 2006, and then I started as a flight medic in 2006 on the civilian side. Still am. So.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Well, who are you working with there?
I work with a company called Airvac Life Team. Okay. I got like 150 helicopters in 15 states. So.
Wow. I got quite a fleet there.
Do you think that that experience on the civilian side helped you?
Oh, absolutely, yes, yeah.
Can you dive into that a little bit?
Yeah, so the dust-off units used to, the only requirement to be a medic on a dust-off is just to be a 68 whiskey with a, you had to be a nationally registered EMT. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to looking at numbers, National Guard units that come through were heavy with civilian paramedics. Mm. And the patient outcome seemed to be a lot better with a guard unit.
Okay.
So the Army changed it in 2013, and all flight medics had to be nationally registered paramedics on the civilian side, you know.
Maintain that currency.
Maintain that and then go through and get your critical care paramedic and flight paramedic certification also.
So. Okay. That's pretty cool. Yeah, I guess since you're operating, you're doing your job full-time at home.
Right.
Whereas a combat medic, when they're home, they're You know, maybe working in the hospital a little bit or doing rotations at the local hospital, maybe.
Yeah, they don't get near the training and stuff, so.
That keeps you sharp.
Yeah.
So what unit were you at? You said you were National Guard the entire time, so I'm assuming you were stationed right here in Tennessee.
I was. When I was a ground medic, I was with a 278th Armored Cavalry Regiment in Tennessee.
Okay.
And then in 2011, I got offered an E-7 slot to go to medevac unit. Mm-hmm. Actually, I got offered in August of 2010. I had just come back from Iraq as a ground medic.
Okay.
In July of 2010, you know, so when they called and offered me the E-7 slot, they're like, hey, before you say yes or no, we are deploying to Afghanistan, and you will be eligible to be deployed, you know. I'm like, okay, I'll take it, you know.
Yeah.
So
you went with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So you went Iraq, came back, and then back to Afghanistan pretty much right away. Yeah. That's a quick turn.
So before we get kind of into your deployments, I'm just very curious, you know, being in Desert Storm and through 9/11, like, how was that experience for you? What was the growth that you saw in the military? The difference in training that you saw within the medics community?
Within the medic community, a lot of the, you know, when I first got in the medic section in 93, we done almost no training whatsoever medic-wise, you know. Mm-hmm. When we go to do our annual training and stuff, we would just go out and support the troops, you know, but we didn't do any training.
So you're just out there holding bandages and water, basically?
Yeah, that's it, you know, and handing out Ranger candy, you know.
Yeah, here's your Motrin.
Motrin. You know, tell people drink water, change their socks, you know. So that was basically it. And then after Desert Storm, they got to thinking, hey, we need to probably up medic training because they're needed, you know.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And then 2002, right after the invasion, our regiment went to NTC, and we were already scheduled to go to NTC, you know. But a lot of the upper, like, squadron leaders and stuff still thought of the medics as they don't do anything, you know. And we had some really good OCs there. It's like, hey, sometime or another, you guys are going to be going to combat, and these guys are going to be saving your butts. You need to treat them as medics, you know. And
yeah, absolutely.
So they started, you know, increasing funding for medic training and stuff. Actually sent us to Fort Sam for some additional training, you know. Okay. Mm-hmm. So.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
So how quickly did you find yourself being deployed to the Middle East?
My first deployment was 2004.
Okay. So sandbags on the Humvees and just logistics at all.
Actually, the 278th, we were in Camp Udari in Kuwait. Hmm. And so I can't think of the Secretary of or Secretary of Defense came over.
Okay.
Somebody from the 278th asked him, he was at a, you know, speaking and stuff, and of course CNN, Fox, and everybody were there, and somebody asked, you know, why we were having to, when we were going to get an actual vehicle so it would protect us instead of using hillbilly armor, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Because we were going out in scrap yards in Kuwait and getting sheet metal and stuff and just welding on the side of the doors.
Yeah, as you much know, as so. You can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did he make a difference?
Not long after that, yes. You wow, know, they're okay. Like, they
needs
started
to
getting,
happen. Yeah, and then the IEDs yeah. like, just started getting blowing up.
Yeah, you know, so I went into Iraq and November of 04.
Mm-hmm.
I went in by ground. Most of our guys, they flew in on Chinooks to the FOB we were going to, but a certain number of us went on convoy, you know, mm-hmm. so we went up Route Tampa.
Okay.
You know, and I'm riding an LNTV that's got sandbags in the floor, and I got a quarter-inch piece of sheet metal in the window, yeah. you know, and that was my up armor, you know. So.
Yeah, that's your armor for the day.
Yeah, that's my armor for the day, you know, so.
Ooh, yeah, I guess that would have been Colin Powell, who probably...
No, it wasn't Colin right? Powell. It was
at the time?
Right one before him.
Yeah, he was...
Yeah, okay. 04.
Secretary of Defense. He was under Bush, but I can't okay. think of his...
Yeah, back then I didn't care.
Yeah, didn't make yeah. too much of a difference. Yeah. Yeah. yeah,
it's the funniest thing, like, while in the military, you just, like, anyone who's, like... two ranks above you, it just yeah. doesn't matter,
yeah.
right?
Right, yeah, doesn't you know. So.
But it does make the biggest difference in the world
right.
when you're like, and I'm sure that was just an off-the-cuff response, too. It's like, what do you need from us, you know,
right.
when we need armor?
Well,
armor would be nice.
There was an embedded reporter from Chattanooga that went with the 278th,
hmm.
and the reporters wasn't allowed to ask anything, so he had one of the guys to ask this question,
oh,
you
yeah.
know, so...
Smart.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's smart. Hey.
Yeah.
Hey, you asked this yeah. question real quick.
Yeah, he had some specialist to ask this question. Yeah, you know, that's like, yeah. you know.
He ain't scared.
Yeah.
So how was that deployment for you? Did you brush off a lot of that training? I mean, were you out often? Like, how was that for you?
You know, I was out quite a bit. I would go out with the guys, you know, quite a bit. So the training come in really, really well, mm-hmm. you know, so...
And you're probably, this paramedic training, you know, has right. helped you keep cool, calm, and collective
yes.
while moving
yeah.
on, and
yeah.
that experience has definitely amped you up a little
yeah.
bit. Yeah, that's got to be crucial, especially if you're not getting the training.
Right,
you know,
yeah, you know.
Pre-9/11.
Yeah. Who are you supporting on that deployment?
We were actually on a FOB. Mm-hmm. Was this all National Guard people? We were doing full spectrum ops.
Okay.
So
kind of isolated to your own FOB then.
Yeah, yeah.
So you guys had your own infantry there and...
We did, you know, and we had about 900 Tennessee Guardsmen on this FOB. And
okay.
We had one infantry company from Wisconsin with us, and but we would go out and do daily patrols in the towns around us and so forth. And
So daily foot patrols, that was...
Daily foot patrols, okay. and yeah, you know, and stuff, so...
Is that the Hearts and Mind time frame?
No.
It was a little bit later, right?
Yeah, 2010, yeah. Second
yeah.
Surge.
Yeah, Second Surge, okay.
Yeah, thank God it wasn't Hearts and Minds back then,
yeah.
because it was the Wild West.
You know, yeah. 2004, 2005, when you drive down the road, you would drive in the middle of the road, and if somebody coming, you know, if,
yep.
if they didn't run off the road...
Yeah.
You would open fire on them, or, yep. you know.
Yeah.
So
force them off the road.
And yeah.
I think
yeah.
that's a really good point, you know, to tell our audience as well, is that that's just how it was. That was the SOP
yeah.
back then, because you would just get V-bids, all these yeah. guys that would come at you. So you had to do it for the safety of the team.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's baffling. You talk about it now, and a lot of people are like, what? Yeah. You just open fire on
yeah.
random? Well, no, these guys are coming at you. They got to know to move out of the way.
Yeah.
Right. You know, same token, the last vehicle, you know, the gunner on the last vehicle, if a vehicle got too close, he would put in rounds into the ground first.
Yeah.
And if they kept coming.
Yeah. We'd give them, you know.
Yeah. You know.
We'd give them the good old red lays first,
yeah.
you know. And 2 seconds later, if you don't, like, slam on the brakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, it's just a different time. So dealing with that deployment and, like, no injuries on your end?
No, but our squadron lost 6 people on that deployment.
Okay. Wow. So you that know? Was a heavy deployment
yeah,
for you.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And the first one.
Yes.
So that had to be extremely eye-opening.
It was, yeah.
Was there any mental preparation before that, or was it just like, this is real, now I'm feeling it?
It's like, this is real, now I'm feeling it, you know? So
you go back home
from
this deployment after losing six people, and it's a little bit different. Now you're in the civilian side of things, too, going back to your job.
Right.
How did you find the way to cope back into that?
You know, I don't know. I didn't really have any problems, you know.
It was just, I mean, you had seen quite a few things as a paramedic.
Right. So, you know, that really prepared me for the deployment, you know, so.
Yeah. Compartmentalized.
Yeah.
Understanding you're not going to end up saving everyone.
Right. Yeah.
It's a little bit harder going into that if you've never done it before.
Right.
Or if it's your first time in combat. Yeah, it can be a little bit more difficult, but I see how that would play into it, definitely.
Yeah.
So you come back, do some more training, I'm sure. And what's the timeline looking like before deploying again?
Come back, done some more training, you know, and then deployed again in 2010 back to Iraq as a ground medic. I tell everybody that was a vacation. We went to Balad for 6 months, you know, and we were doing convoy security, so we'd only go out one night a week.
Oh, that's not bad.
You know, had 6 nights a week off, so.
Fat camp, basically, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, one night a week, we would be like, midnight, we'd be driving through Baghdad and stuff, you know, escorting vehicles and stuff. But squadron had no injuries at deployment, you know, so.
Which has got to be a huge relief after the
first
one.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Because, I mean, you build that up, and you have 6 years to build that up, too, is what do I expect?
Right.
So sharpening your skills, doing all the training to lead up to that, being the best you can, I'm assuming, and then getting there, and it was anticlimactic.
Right, yeah, you know.
Which is a good day.
It really was, but, you know, I was a senior medic in 2010 with a infantry company, and all these guys are 19, 20 years old, just out of basic, you know.
Yeah.
And they're all wanting to do something, you know. And
yeah, understandably.
The only time they actually got to fire their weapons was in the, you know, when you'd leave the FOB, you would do a weapons check, you know. They'd get to shoot 50 cal then, that was it, you know. So
It's always the worst, too, for an infantryman because you have to clean your weapon right after.
Right.
Every time, yeah.
So. I remember specifically being in combat. I'm like, do I want to shoot? Because I'm going to have to clean my rifle. But, you know, that's a funny thing, too, is you see in the younger guys going in, as they're just ready for it. And then when you get to it, you're like, oof.
Right.
Let's not do that again.
Yeah.
But all that mental preparation prepared you for the worst, but you got to hope for the best on that one.
Absolutely.
So that was how long, that deployment?
That was only 6 months.
6 months.
Yeah.
And you're back home and then went down range again.
Yeah.
Within 2 years.
Yeah. I went back down range and deployed in March of 2012.
Okay. So you have an ample amount of experience at this point.
Yes.
Right? And you've been with the Guard at how long at this point?
At this point, I've been with the Guard 23 years, so.
Yeah.
Wow.
Substantial amount of time.
Yeah, 24 years, yeah.
So I'm sure that your kind of mission parameters change to help and train the younger
absolutely.
Folks
yes.
coming
yeah.
in and,
yeah.
and getting your leadership experience there.
Right. Yeah.
So 2012 is the deployment.
Yes.
Where shit just goes crazy from there.
Yeah.
And so let's paint the scene. So you get back home, you do your training, and it's a quick turnaround.
Quick turnaround, yeah.
And then how's that deployment look?
You know, we knew we were going to be busy, but nobody had any idea how busy or exactly what we would be doing, you know. My medevac unit, probably 75% of them had never deployed before.
Oh, wow.
You know, so I'm on my third deployment, you know.
They're relying on you.
Yeah, you know, and I'm like, hey, it's a piece of cake, you know.
But, yeah. The last one was
the
easy.
Last one.
Yeah, you know. And
it's like an emotional roller coaster, you know. The first one, you just got to prepare for the worst.
Right, you know, and pilot-wise, like on the civilian side where I fly at, a pilot has to have 2,000 hours flight hours before they can apply for the job.
Sure.
And my medevac unit, over half the pilots had less than 300 hours flight time, you know.
Oh, man.
You know, so it's like,
yeah,
I'm flying with guys that don't know how to fly, you know, but they were awesome pilots. But, you know, it's just...
Yeah, 300 hours of solid training at least,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So
those are really low hours to be flying out in combat with.
Yeah.
So are they relying on you guys in the back a little bit more with your experience? Because obviously you've been flying for a couple of years at that point.
So the pilot in charge, most of them were, you know, of course you fly with two pilots in the Black Hawk. The PC would have 1,000-plus hours. So,
okay, that's good.
But... You know,
most of the co-pilots
had less than 300 hours. Yeah. You know, so
was that something that kept you on edge?
It did at first, you know, and then I got faith in my pilots extremely quick, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, build up that crew resource.
Right, you know,
how did that feel going from ground to helicopter?
Of course, I was flying on the civilian side, so
yeah.
I really, really love flying, you know, so.
Yeah, also just being away from the IEDs, I think
that's a huge. Being away from the IEDs, you know, of course, I mean, we first got in country, every time a helicopter flies, it gets shot at, you know, but after like the first week of that, you're like, they can't hit us, you know, so it's no worry, you know, so.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's a good mentality to have.
You know, I mean. Flying with MVGs, you know, in that time, you would see the machine gun fire in the air at the helicopters, but you're like...
They can't see us.
They can't see us, you know, and then they... I tell everybody that good thing Afghanis didn't know how to duck hunt because they don't know how to lead, you know, so...
Yeah,
also true. Yeah, I remember someone shooting at us broad daylight, it must have been noon, flying at like 1,500 feet. Watch this guy.
Yeah.
You see a little silhouette, like walk out. He walks outside of his hut, walks back inside, grabs something, walks back out, aims up at us. And I see just little flashes. I'm like, really? Like,
yeah. And, you know,
what are you shooting at? They're not going to hit us from there, dude.
You know, they're not leading you. So they're shooting at the aircraft and you're way past it when the bullet gets there. So, you know, it's
500 meters behind you by the time it gets there. So. Yeah. Just laugh at them. Like, you're not going to hit us, man.
So you're spun up. And you're on the bird. You're probably the most experienced at this point.
I am, yes.
You're a little skeptical about the piloting, but they proved themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And how does that roll out? Like, are you going out on a nightly basis? Like you said, it amplified quite substantially from your second deployment.
Little perspective, my unit, we were there for 9 months. We were on 4 FOBs. Had a total of 15 aircraft on 4 FOBs, but you had first up, second up, third up and fourth up, and that we flew 975 patients in the 9 months.
Wow.
You know, so.
Wow.
That's a lot.
970 of them was trauma patients.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're doing a couple a night.
Yeah, yeah.
On average.
Yeah, so.
That's a busy deployment. Where were you flying out of? Because I know you were in RC South, right?
I was in Helmand Province.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
fun.
Yeah,
it's a fun one.
We were on Marine FOBs. Mm-hmm. That's where our medevac unit was. So
you were on Bastion or Leatherneck?
No. We were on the little bitty FOBs. We were.
Oh, okay.
I was. We had bases at Dwyer,
mm-hmm.
Delaram, FOB Payne.
Yeah.
And Shukvani. Yep. It used to be Edinburgh, and then they changed it to Shukvani.
Yeah, Shukvani. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I was at a Bastion the year after you. So spent a lot of time in that area.
Yeah.
It's not a fun area.
So. Yeah, that's like right smack dab in the middle of the Hearts and Minds campaign. So it, like, the rules of engagement changes quite substantially. I'm sure you didn't see a lot of that change.
No, but
you definitely saw an influx of injury, though.
Oh yes, yeah.
And that's an interesting one too. Just understanding the SOPs that go into it, and then all of a sudden the injuries go up, and the wounded goes up. Because I mean, the rules of engagement we got briefed on was just like you won't fire unless they're firing back at you, and it obviously changed quite. The vehicle's coming at me, I'll just clear them out with some gunfire, and that went out the window.
Yeah,
So interesting, just hearing that from a medic perspective, seeing those numbers go up.
Yeah,
in 2010, when we were out on the road. You could not fire back unless you could positively ID the person that fired at you, you know? Yeah. So in other words.
And I'm definitely looking very closely at who's firing.
Yeah. You know,
while they're doing it. Yeah.
Well, so, I'm just going to peek real quick.
I can hear the bullets. Yeah. But, just need to make sure you're shooting at me.
But so, you can't shoot back. You know, it's basically.
What was the stipulations? You had to see the white of their eyes.
pretty much. Yeah. You know,
Wild. So it's wild to think about, like, you know, putting stipulations on wartime environment like
that. Right. Yeah.
So let's talk about that night. So you get like you are obviously burned out. You got to be at this point.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, just running on empty.
Right.
900 plus individuals. So this is just another routine call to you.
Well, so actually, they took our medevac unit, took a couple of aircraft. They took the most experienced people. Mm-hmm. And we went to a little SAF compound outpost outside of FOB TK. Mm-hmm. And I think it was called Camp Cobra where we were at.
Yeah. Mm.
So we took two medevac aircraft there. We had no chase birds, you know. So we were there to support. The Aussies was going to do a – they were going to raid a Taliban training camp, you know. Mm. So, of course – when we're there for it, it's zero moon, you know, which it's extremely dark in Afghanistan. So
good for ground, bad for pilots.
Yeah, you know, so zero illumination, you know, and so the night it kicked off, we're actually sitting in the operations tent of the SAF compound, and it first comes over the radio that a Osprey had crashed with 28 Australians on board, you know. Mm. So we're scrambling to get the aircraft, and then we found out it was Marine Huey that had crashed. So, you know, I don't know if you know how, I don't know whether Pedro done this the same way or not. Medevac, you couldn't launch until you got launch approval, you know.
Yeah.
So we're sitting there spooled up waiting for them to go, hey, you can launch, you know, so.
Yeah, waiting for command authority.
Yeah, so.
So you're following this objective.
Yes.
You're following this operation.
Yes.
You're assigned to it.
Yes.
And I'm assuming you're in the talk watching the ISR footage of this.
Yeah.
And it's got to be centric on the objective.
Yes.
So, like, what did you feel before that? Did you have any weird feelings about this one?
I did not, no.
It's just routine.
Just routine, you know.
More like chomping at the bit to go.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you're just like...
Yeah. It's usually if you're waiting for command or launch authority, you're sitting there like, you're watching it happen. Like, we can be there right now. What are you waiting for?
Yeah, you know,
and some colonel or general has to check his boxes beforehand. You know, they usually want to make sure that the helicopter didn't get shot down and send another one right in for a SAR trap.
Right.
It was pretty common, like... mid-2000s, late-2000s, early, you know, early 2010s, they were doing SAR traps. So they'd shoot something down. They wouldn't do anything else to the survivors. They'd let them, you know, sit there and wait for medevac to show up, then they'd blow up the medevac bird.
Yeah, that was...
Yeah.
They, I guess they got rewards for...
Oh, yeah.
For shooting a medevac bird,
you know? Yeah, big time.
So, and we had the Red Cross on the side, you know, as a good target. I mean...
Yeah, it's easy to aim at.
Man, so you hear the bird goes down.
Yes.
You think 28 are on board?
Well, they first tell us the Osprey had crashed with 28 Australians on board, you know. So we didn't know until after we launched that it was a Marine Huey that had crashed, you know, and said, and they told us then, you know, that two Australian snipers had been killed in the crash.
And this is before launch approval.
This is just right after launch approval.
Okay, so you're on en route.
We're en route, yeah.
Yeah, and you're getting intel in flight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are. So, of course, we're going to a place we'd never been to, you know. We had to climb to like 13,000 foot to get through a mountain pass. And then since we went through the mountain pass, we pretty much had to auto-rotate down to the LZ.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, with the NVGs on, when it's so dark like that and no light, it's almost like looking at snow. It's really, you know, so.
All the scintillation everywhere. Yeah,
you know, and so, you know, we knew there was an AC-130 overhead.
Mm-hmm.
So we had them sparkle to light up the LZ for us, you know.
Okay.
And of course, we got our takedown. And our first attempt to land, at about 50 foot, we had a complete brownout, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a captain on the controls at the time. We had a CW5 with us, you know. The captain aborted. The CW5's like, hey, I got the controls. He come around, back around really quick, and he's like, this place doesn't look as dusty. And he just slammed us on the ground at like a 12-degree bank angle.
Incline? You know? Oh, man.
You know, I mean, he's like, within 15 seconds, we're sitting there, you know. Yeah. And so they come with the four Marines, and of course, Ryan was on a stretcher. The mm-hmm. other three were ambulatory, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, we, they told us that Ryan, of course, like I say, it rolled over Ryan as well.
Mm-hmm.
They told us that Ryan actually dug himself out and got the other three Marines out of the aircraft before he went down. So, you know, so then they brought him to us and
loaded him up in the helicopter.
We flew him to TK, you know, to the.
And at this point, Pedro was long gone, right?
No, Pedro was still there.
Okay, Pedro was still there.
Pedro come back in, and they recovered the two Aussies and stuff. And
yeah, from our understanding, they dropped off a couple of PJs who did the exfiltration or the extraction rather.
Yeah.
While the other two guys walked Ryan down the hill to where you guys met them, right?
And when you get on scene, what's going on through your head? What are you seeing? What are you triaging? Like, paint that picture a little bit.
Okay. You know, so as soon as we land, the medics never got out of the aircraft. You know, we would sling the door open and they would come and throw the patient in the aircraft. And as soon as I shut the door, I'd be like, let's roll, you know? Mm-hmm. So, then I would start, I started working on Ryan, triaging Ryan, and I had another medic with me, and she started triaging the others as well, you know, and stuff.
And what are the injuries that you're seeing?
The only thing with Ryan, he was severe pain. I didn't see anything physical-wise, but he was in severe back pain, you know, so.
Yeah, and what do you do for that? Like, you just give him a fentanyl pop? But he's got, his jaw was broken too, right?
I don't know. I don't remember that. I just know that he was severe back pain, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was only like a 5-minute flight. I don't remember us giving him anything for pain just because it was so quick.
And such a short flight.
Such a short flight, you know.
So you guys flew him back to TK and then transloaded him from there?
We flew him back to TK. Of course, TK had their own medevac. We left and we went back to the Camp Cobra to be back.
Mm-hmm. And then go back up on alert, right?
Go back on alert, yeah. So,
I mean, it was just another ambulance service.
Yeah.
That's how it felt, right?
Yeah.
Except, I mean, I'm sure it was a little bit more real when we recognized that it's Americans, right?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, and then it's even more real because it was a helicopter crash. Helicopter. You know, and you're flying in helicopters. So, you know, you really have a close connection with helicopter people, you know? Yeah. So,
it's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way you. Picked up a little bird that had crashed right outside of Kandahar in 2013. It was a husband and wife that were in a formation flight, and the wife's little bird went down. And so he was first on scene, and we were second on scene. Like, there's a weird connection you have with the other rotary wing people. When you see a helicopter goes down, everyone stops. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's a good reminder that these can ball up really quickly, and like this is quite dangerous to be flying these around in hot, you know, high altitude, dusty environments.
Absolutely.
These little things can take you out real quick.
And you had a bird go down, right? So your pilots were probably a little more on edge than usual.
Mm-hmm. They were. You know, the CW5, he had over 10,000 hours flight time in a Black Hawk, you know.
Yeah. So. Okay. You get a CW5, you're probably okay.
You know, he'd been on multiple deployments, you know,
probably through Vietnam too.
You know, he hadn't been in that long, but I mean, he'd flown, Hueys, you know, Black Hawks, he'd flown Cobras, he flew Sherpas, you know,
it's a pilot you can trust then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's reassuring. So it's interesting to build the picture like this, that the most influential or the most pivotal night of someone else's life can just be 5-10 minutes for you.
Right.
And it makes not a whole lot of a difference, because from your perspective, Ryan's injuries weren't grave. They, you know, he wasn't dying immediately. It was a quick flight there, quick flight back. And that's just, it's routine almost.
Almost, yes.
But for him, from his perspective, it's
that's
the most, his entire life changed.
Right.
In that five minutes for you, his entire life changed. It's weird to build that perspective out, but I'm sure you have a couple pickups or a couple memories that really stand out, that are really pointed to you, that might have changed your perspective on some things.
I do, yeah.
Was there anything on that deployment that stood out specifically?
You know, I flew a little 2-year-old girl who was an IED blast, lost both her legs, and one arm was degloved and lost her thumb off the other, you know.
Wow.
We actually followed up with her. She had a complete recovery, and, you know, so.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Those ones were a little bit more difficult dealing with the kids, but that's something not a lot of people realize is, you know, Afghanistan, is it a war zone? Absolutely. But there's also families that
we flew civilians as well, you know, so.
Quite often, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Dealing with the kids was a little bit more difficult on my end too. You know, doing the best you can for them, but at the same time, like, there should not be children in a war zone environment. Right. And here they are.
Yeah. And that's the stuff that resonates. I mean, in the military, you're picking up the troops that you expect. Yeah. You know, they know what they signed up for. And to see the collateral damage outside of that, it's just really eye-opening as well. Did you have kids at the time?
Yes. Hmm.
Yeah. So that probably just resonated with you in a different way as well. Yeah. So, like, during your deployment, was there any moments where you felt like you might not be making it back home?
Oh yeah. We flew a Afghani soldier into the capital city of Helmand Province, Lashkargah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there was a little British outpost there, you know, and so it was our first time flying in there, you know, and as you fly in, of course, you're flying at 100 foot above the buildings, you know.
Yeah. It's a built-up city there, too.
Yeah, and it looks like, the first time flying in there, it looked like the scene of going into Mogadishu, you know?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And we're just like, none of us had ever been there before, and we're all like, oh, crap, you know? So we drop our patient off. As soon as we lift out of this little British outpost, you know, and of course, I mean, anytime you took off, the pilots are yanking and banking, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And as we take off and we maybe get 200 meters away from the British outpost, I see this guy come out from behind a tree with RPG, you know.
Ugh.
And I just see this bright flash, and it went right behind us, you know. So.
Yep. Right through the tail.
I mean, you know, I just missed the tail. Just sort of like went between the two aircraft, you know, and we're just like, crap, you know.
And it happens so quickly.
Yeah, it does.
From the flash to the time it went through the tail.
Yeah.
How long was that? Less than a second?
Yeah. Yeah, you know.
No time to react.
You know, when I seen a guy step out, I mean, I didn't even have time to say RPG or anything. You know, it's just like, as soon as he stepped out, it's just like he fired, you know. And,
yeah. I had something very similar happen at Lashkargah, same area. We were on approach into Lashkargah, though, and saw a flash from underneath us and a trail of white smoke. But it was so quick. You get up on comms, like, never mind, continue. Yeah. He's already gone. Like,
yeah.
we avoided it.
Happens quick.
Yeah.
My 47 was hit by an RPG, and that was like, it was just like, nope, you don't expect it, right? It's just a knock on the door.
Yeah.
From our perspectives, we're bolted in the back, you know, with all our gear, and just everybody's just all sardines.
Yeah.
You know? And, but RPGs, man, those are wicked, wicked things. I had a buddy too that was a little off topic, but. The fin of the RPG severed his leg. It was so close to him.
Yeah.
Man, and you just hear all these horrendous stories of these things. People think like it's like the movies where they shoot it and you have time to maneuver the plane. Yeah. And they just do not move that quickly.
Yeah.
So eye-opening experiences. So you probably felt the heart rate on that one.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then what was your response to that? Like, I mean, you're still in the mix of it.
Right.
Right?
You know. I mean, I'm first like, oh crap, RPG. And I start to say something, you know, I don't say anything because we don't have time to react, you know. And then when it missed us, I'm like, holy crap, you guys see that? And of course, I'm sitting on the left seat, crew seat of the aircraft, you know. The pilot on the left side, he goes, oh yeah, I saw it, you know. And it's, we're just like, they missed, you know.
And, couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. Whew. Yeah, that's crazy. And I'm sure there was quite a few of those close calls.
There was, yeah.
But never a down bird on your end.
No.
And anyone injured in your crew before?
No.
That's a blessing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we've done the whole 9 month deployment with zero injuries or anything. So.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was that your last deployment?
It was. Mm. Yeah.
And did you decide to get out after that, or?
I did. I got home. You know, December 2012, and I'm like, April 2013. I'm like, I got up one morning. I'm like, I'm done. Mm. You know.
What was the biggest deciding factor for you?
You know, I just woke up and was like, I'm done, you know. Yeah.
Just like when you joined?
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to exit the same way.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, and did a lot of these faces come back to play, like the girl into your decision, or was it just like, I'm going to count my blessings right now and be done?
I'm just going to count my blessings and be done.
Yeah.
Well, at that point, you had been in for over 25 years.
Right? Over 25 years, so I'm like.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah.
Yeah.
I could see that's enough service at that point. Yeah. You're also doing the same exact job, you know, on the civilian side.
I'd always said I was going to stay in as long as I was healthy and happy, you know, which I was, you know. And then I'm like, I got up one morning, I'm like, just don't do it anymore. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the right time then, which is a good thing, because not a lot of people get that opportunity to make the decision for themselves, especially at 25 years.
Right.
Not a lot of people make it to even close to 25 years.
Oh, I know.
And make the decision for themselves. Usually it's 25 years, like, hey, you're a little broken. You need to be on your way.
25 years of picking up individuals who don't have that option too.
Yeah.
Like that's gotta mean something as well. I mean, I just have to ask, did you feel bulletproof?
No. Well, some days I did, but you know. Yeah. But you know, I mean, there's a lot of mornings you'd get up and you're like, is today the day, you know?
Yeah. Because luck can only get you so far, right?
Yeah.
And just, so you had a family at the time.
Yeah.
And that's probably the most reasonable choice to make as well.
Yeah. I was single at the time, but I had two kids, you know, and I'm just like, which made them very happy when I retired.
I'm sure.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get dad away from the danger a little bit.
Yeah.
So over the course, you've been a paramedic for...
I've been a paramedic for over 30 years.
30 years now.
Yeah.
So over your 30-year career, what has been the most efficient way for you to deal with things like mental health? So dealing with the things that you encounter, you know, the problems you're trying to fix for people, trying to save people's lives, losing people, whatever it is there an approach that you take to compartmentalize or to help process that, or is it just something that comes naturally for you?
I think it's something that comes natural, you know, but... I have a lot of hobbies, you know. I mean, I hunt, I fish, you know, ride motorcycles, camp, you know. So,
so there's nothing that really like sets it apart that you're able to deal with those things. It just came naturally for you, huh?
It just came naturally. Yeah.
Wonder if that comes from that like a service mindset, or you know you're there to provide something and you're doing the best you can for other people.
I think that's a lot of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know that you're staying on top of your training to make sure you can provide the best solutions for them, right?
Right. Yeah.
So you didn't struggle with any post-traumatic stress?
You know,
any substance
actually,
abuse?
Actually, when I came back 2013, I did have PTSD, you know.
Okay.
For like 6, 7, 8 months.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I don't care where I was at, how big a crowd I was in or whatever. I always just felt like I was alone, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
So.
And do you still feel that way sometimes? I imagine.
No, not really, but.
Yeah.
I mean, it took me probably a year to get over that feeling, you know.
And what helped?
I don't know.
You just got over it naturally.
I mean, when I was around my kids, I didn't feel alone. But other than that, you know.
See, it's very curious that something we see quite often with our medical professionals is they have a tendency to be a little less affected by this. And I think that Christian nailed it on the head as well, is that, you know, you're going in to save lives, not take lives.
Right.
So that's a huge difference.
Right.
And we know from just countless stories that even taking the lives of an enemy affects you negatively.
Right.
But to go in and do your best to bring back those who are going out and sacrificing so much as well, has got to be a reason why it doesn't sting so bad. Right. Do you think that's it?
It could be part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in all your years, you got to be contemplating this as well. It's right. Like, why are some people so affected while I'm not? Have you ever asked yourself that question?
I have. Yeah. 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 So
any conclusions you came to
or no. Just, I just seem live to be able to compartmentalize it, you know, and
yeah. I think that's it too, is that another step to that is the ability to compartmentalize, especially you had that in, you know, your experience with it being a paramedic.
Right.
So you were kind of predisposed to that
right.
in the beginning. Yeah.
Just wasn't used to trauma on that scale
sure.
every single day, you know.
Yeah. So did it make being a paramedic on the civilian side just a cakewalk?
Made it a lot easier, yeah.
And no one's shooting at you.
Right.
Hopefully.
Right. No.
It just depends on where you're
at. Yeah. It depends on where you're at, but yeah.
Where you're at. Yeah. So you get out in 2013.
Yeah.
You go through about a year transition.
Right.
You're still a paramedic at
right.
the time.
Yeah.
So that helps you just kind of reintegrate back a little bit. I think that's a huge thing too. We mentioned the hobbies, right?
Right.
Isolation and no support system, it cultivates that environment of post-traumatic stress, anxiety disorder. So what kind of hobbies were you doing in the meantime?
You know, I was doing a lot of motorcycle riding.
Okay.
And, of course, I love to hunt, fish, that kind of thing. So I was doing that and spent a lot of time with my kids, you know. So
there you go. Keeps your head right.
Yeah, yeah.
So you got out, like Dave said, 2013. And are you still, you're still a flight paramedic today?
Yes, I am.
So you're taking that to the end, huh?
Yeah.
You're going to do that until the wheels fall off?
Do that for about 2 more years, I hope. So.
2 more years?
Yeah.
Two more years.
Yeah.
2 more years. Then what's next?
Going to retire, enjoy life.
Yeah.
That's right. Hunt and fish.
Hunt and fish. And camp. Fish.
And that's right. Are you still engaged with the military at all?
No.
Did you stay, I know that experience had to be something that your leadership team did not want to let go. Did they ask you to do some extended work at the end, or?
Not really, no. So
it was just out.
Just
isn't that the weirdest feeling?
It is.
25 years being indoctrinated into, this cult-like environment.
Yeah,
I like to say.
Yeah. So
it really is, though.
And then, just bringing it back to those that you dropped off, you know, both on the civilian side and in the military side, Did you think of any faces? Did anything like come back to you, or was it just over?
No, I mean, they still come back to me at times, and stuff, and
I'm sure the losses are hard too.
Yeah,
along
the
way, those ones are the ones that resonate the most, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But so, what's day to day look like now for you as a paramedic, flight paramedic?
I got a job where I work 2 weeks on, and I'm off 2 weeks.
Okay, that's lovely.
So in my 2 weeks I work, I travel to 15 different states, you know, so I get to travel, get the privilege of flying people that I don't know who they are, you know, and stuff. So that makes it easier, you know.
Yeah, do you ever get a chance to, on the civilian side, given this is a reconnection episode, do you ever get a chance to really follow up with some of the people you're picking up? Because on the military side, we're never really afforded that opportunity,
right,
especially
in
combat, right?
Yeah, we didn't know names, you know, and stuff.
Nothing.
Yeah.
So are you afforded that opportunity more on the civilian side? Can you
call
the hospitals and follow up?
Yeah.
Is that something that you routinely do, or is that something you have done?
It's something I have done. I try to do quite often, so.
Yeah. Make sure that they're getting proper care throughout.
Yeah. It's kind of something that Ryan was talking to us about is that, you know, this is the most severe day they've ever faced in their life. And they're just so thankful. And, you know, being rescued myself, like, you know, having the opportunity to connect with those personnel that were on scene, you just think about them every single day, you know? And it's just so routine for you, but do you feel that still? Do you understand that?
I do, yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's gotta be potent as well.
Yeah.
Just lost, you know, like for me, I have no idea who it was. It's just like heroes under a banner, you know? So that's got to be a crazy one too, when you think about those faces and just like, I wonder what they're doing now, you know?
Yeah,
that's got to be, that would keep me up at night sometimes.
Yeah, but I think that's, it's also what puts the, I don't want to say pride, but it's what puts the pride behind the Red Cross on the side of the helicopter, right? Because you don't know who picked you up, but it was a Red Cross on the side of a helicopter, which should make people who wear that, who sport that, you know, who operate under that flag, should make them proud of what they do. You know, I know that I'm part of this group who saves lives. Same thing with the Green Feet, right? In rescue. Like I may not have had an impact on everyone's life, but I've had an impact on some people's, and it's, you know, proud to be associated with those things. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, from your perspective, I'm sure it would change, Dave, I'm sure it would change a lot of things for you to meet the person who saved your life, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
From our perspective, it's probably a little bit more weird, I guess. Yeah. I don't know how I would feel if I met someone, you know, who I had picked up. What are your thoughts on that? Are you looking forward to this reconnection? What is it going to do for you? Is that going to help close some doors, or
absolutely,
answer some questions?
It's so interesting hearing both sides of the story, the perspectives. You know, when Ryan talks about it, it's just like this in depth, every single detail from smelling the fuel and tasting the fuel, the dirt in his mouth and blah, blah, blah. And then to see your side of things where it's just like, it's the day in the life. You know, this is routine as it can be. And it's not even the most substantial rescue that I've done. That has got to be, that's just perspective all in itself. It's pretty incredible. And I mean, looking forward to the opportunity of letting you guys sit together for the first time in a while. Super exciting.
It is,
Well, Bernie, do you have anything that you want to leave for the audience? Any points of wisdom or encouragement?
I do not.
Nothing at all?
Oh,
you got something. You've been a paramedic for over 30 years, my friend.
How about like some inspiring words to those who are considering joining rescue or, you know, being a medic?
It's the best job ever.
I love it. Simple. Yeah. Simple but elegant.
Best job ever.
You get to save people's lives and make an impact where it counts.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So. Yeah. I think we're going to showcase that here very shortly.
Awesome.
Well, Bernie, we really appreciate your time today. Thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you
for coming all the way
me.
Out. Yeah, absolutely. We're really looking forward to the next one and watching you and Ryan get back together.
Awesome.
First time in over 10 years.
Yes. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again for coming on and sharing.
Thank you guys for having me.
Absolutely.
This has been the Medevac Podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for watching part 2 of 3 with our reconnection episode with Bernie Copeland, Ryan Layton. If you missed the first part, go back and check that out. The story is a little bit longer, but very, very detailed. And keep an eye out next week when we introduce these two gentlemen back to each other. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Bye.